All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Be seated. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the third case of the day in Canyon County for the Idaho Supreme Court today. And this matter is entitled State of Idaho versus Patrick Mims Aguilavoy. Mr. Aguilavoy is appealing, represented here by Brian Dixon, and the state is responding through Mark Olson. Counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters for us today?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Dixon, please.
May it please the court. Judge Mitchell, who presided over Mr. Aguilavoy's trial, recognized that he erred by helping the prosecutor in the jury's presence to create an admissible version of one of the state's trial exhibits. As such, the only question for this court, really, is how to remedy that acknowledged error. Idaho Rule 605 and the Fundamental Error Doctrine each provide a mechanism by which this court can remedy that error. Either way, that remedy should simply be to strike the sentencing enhancement, since the record demonstrates that this error amounted to egregious government conduct which substantially prejudiced Mr. Aguilavoy, as it was literally the difference between his conviction and acquittal on the sentencing enhancement. Turning first to Rule 605, I would note initially that Rule 605 is broad enough to encompass this sort of interjection from the bench. Rule 605, by its plain terms, prevents a judge from, quote, testifying as a witness in the trial. The comments to the identical federal rule on which our Rule 608 was based made it clear that this was to be a broad rule of incompetence. And so when we look at it, what a witness does is either present extrinsic information based on their own observations or vouch for the credibility of other evidence based on their knowledge. At least those are the definitions the state's brief gives us. Judicial comments from the bench can serve both functions, and we need only look to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Quercia to see that, where the judge comments that he observed the defendant making particular hand motions during his testimony and then opines that that makes his testimony less credible. He's acting as a witness even though he's not on the witness stand, like Justice Stegner is here. Not implying that Rule 605 applies in this situation.
I understand.
But the point is that because these sort of judicial comments from the bench serve the same function as witness testimony, they should also fall under Rule 605. And as the Seventh Circuit pointed out, Rule 605 would indeed serve little purpose if it were limited just to formal testimony from under oath. Several states and federal circuits have read their versions of Rule 605 to this effect as well. So the question here is, did the judge effectively take on the role of the witness? And the answer is absolutely.
Does it matter if what the judge allegedly testified to wasn't something that was a fact of consequence at the trial? An underlying question here is, was the date of the certification important or necessary for its admissibility?
It is still important that the judge is then intervening to make an alteration to the exhibit, even if what he's making is ultimately technical or irrelevant.
But if he testified to something that didn't need to be proved to establish an element of the case, does it matter?
It does, because he's still reflecting, he's still vouching for the credibility of that exhibit. He's taking away a basis to argue that it is not properly certified, and therefore there's reasonable doubt that it is a conviction of Mr. Aguilavoy's that should be used.
Was there an argument that it wasn't properly certified?
There was not an argument to that basis. Well, the foundation argument kind of incorporates that, that it's not properly certified. And as we get into the meat of that issue, Rule 9024, which is copies of official documents, requires that they be certified as correct either by a signature and seal purporting to that effect or by a certification that satisfies one of the other subsections of the rule, i.e. court rule or statute. None of those happen here because the date is required for all of them. 902, none of these versions, none of these varying pieces of 902 actually define what that certification must include. However, the legislature has provided us with that definition in Code Section 9-1406, which lays out the form for a certification when a law or a court rule requires it. And it has in its plain language a specific blank that says date. By the plain language of the statute, the date is required in the form to be substantively conforming to the certification requirement.
But that statute says at the end in substantially the following form. It doesn't say exactly the following form.
Right, and that's where you look at the stamp on this page, which has signed and sealed this blank date of such and such, you know, this blank date of blank, instead of just the blank line with date underneath it. It's presenting the same information in a different form. That's substantially conforming. To eliminate that piece entirely is not substantially conforming to this, to what the statute requires. It's missing a piece. And I would point out that having a date on an execution of a writing allows us to see, you know, when that happened, and allows us to have the, it gives the, I guess, the presumption of accuracy in this case, that the person signing it is actually authorized to use the seal. Not, you know, for example, if the person is hired on January 15th, and the seal is executed on January 1st by that person, they aren't authorized to use the seal. That seal is dysfunctional. But if the seal is signed on January 31st, no problem. They're under the power of their seal, under their oath. That's what the date gives us. It allows us to say, yes, this is all well and good, and allows us to check it and verify if we believe that there's an error in that regard, and that's why it's still a critical component. And we need the month as part of that, because just to say the 21st of 2021, as the original certification did here, gives us no idea when in the year of 2021 we're talking about. And so we miss that critical kind of verification, that critical piece of authorization that says this is a valid copy. You can rely on its contents under the auspice of law without having somebody come and testify to the fact. That's what 902 is. It circumvents the need to bring the clerk into court to testify. I am the custodian of this. I made a copy of this document. It is accurate. It's a simplification, but we still need that to make sure that the simplification is doing what it's supposed to do.
And so my struggle with the judge's testifying argument is that it wasn't the judge said, go ahead and insert January on the seal. The judge just said, go find the clerk who executed this. And I'm not getting into whether that was right or wrong. But he didn't get up and say, put this here. He said, go find the person who did this, if you can find her, and see if she can complete this.
Sure. And the problem with that is now he's conducting a fact-finding investigation in the presence of the jury into a thing that the prosecutor should have done well in advance of trial. And as the Vermont case from 2010, Gokey points out, that sort of investigation is itself a violation of 605, because now the judge, even when the information comes in, is still providing extrinsic information that he has directed discovered.
But the key is providing. I mean, doesn't a judge make an implicit finding every time the judge admits an exhibit at trial? It makes a finding that there's a foundation for the document? I mean, again, there's a certain amount of a judge admitting an exhibit that gives an imprimatur to the exhibit as being official, right?
Yes, and that's where the Indiana Court of Appeals decision in Ferguson is particularly useful in breaking this issue down. What Indiana said is that the line that the U.S. Supreme Court has long since drawn between proper and improper judicial conduct, statements that add to or distort the evidence versus comments that analyze or dissect the evidence in making foundational rulings on objections, for example, that's one of them. That's the line between testifying as a witness and serving as legal arbiter.
So let me give you a common hypothetical that happened probably every other trial I ever did. Somebody offers an exhibit. The defense objects, say this wasn't authenticated, makes a speaking objection, says this wasn't authenticated, Judge. And the judge responds, oh no, I think it was authenticated, I'm going to admit it. Did he just testify?
He did not, because he's...
But it kind of sounds to me like he did.
He did not, because he's not changing, he's making an evaluation of the evidence that was before him. He's not adding to it like we've got the judge in this case directing.
Wait a minute now. Let me quote from him. He said, Exhibit 7A and B are admitted without objection. Mm-hmm. 7C, we will check to see if that deputy clerk is here and if that clerk can correct that deficiency based on the objection of defense, as I understand.
Sure.
If not, then the state's going to have to submit a new 7C to the clerk of the court. Now, admittedly, I guess that could be considered he directed what's to happen if the clerk's not here, but did he really direct anything about what information was placed on the exhibit?
He does, and this is where the Ninth Circuit decision in Edwards becomes useful as an example or as a comparison. In Edwards, they're looking at prosecutor. In that case, the prosecutor is present and helps search the defendant's bag and the prosecutor himself finds an inculpatory receipt. The prosecutor then proceeds to call an officer who was there to the stand to testify about the search of the bag, and yes, the receipt was found in the bag. He's doing this all in question. He's not saying any of, like, I found this, jury. He's not doing the traditional vouching. But the Ninth Circuit said that even that, the presentation of the thing that you found through the other, I keep adjusting it, you just, because that's where the witness box is, I'm sorry. By doing that presentation, even through the third-party witness, he's still acting as a, quote, silent witness, throwing his vouching into effect. He's telling the, when the officer says, yes, you found the receipt in the bag, now the prosecutor is a witness. He's information that he found, his credibility is now on the line. It comes into play. And it's vouching, even though the prosecutor is not saying, yes, I found it, therefore you should believe the trustworthy. You could, again, when we're talking about 605 in this context, it's less overt conduct. I forget which of the courts used the less overt conduct language, but it's not the judge in the box saying, yes, I did this, I found this information, that's what it is. It's the judge making it happen. And the fact that it's all happening at the bench with the jury in the room is particularly problematic here, especially the second correction. Right, where we come back, we've got the clerk who's added the month into it but hasn't actually initialed that she made a correction to the document. And then that happens on the bench with the jury in the room. Right, that's where we're seeing the vouching. That's the more direct, you know, Cummins, you know, initial here. You know, the indication, at least from our records, that what's going on that second time. And that's, again, we get that vouching for this is reliable information, the jury, you should consider. And that's the problem here.
So would it be vouching if the district court had said to the prosecutor, do you want to call the deputy clerk as a witness? Do you want to call her to testify?
No, I don't think that would be vouching because it's an open-ended question. He's not directing anything to happen. He's asking the prosecutor what the prosecutor wants to do. And here, by the way, we've got evidence that the prosecutor would not have done it. The prosecutor's strategy was to abandon 7C, present Exhibit 7D of the California conviction that he initially intended not to present and just go to the verdict on 7A, 7B, and 7D.
And so I struggle with, if that's not testimony, why is it testimony for him to say, let's see if we can find the clerk who did this?
It's about the agency and the question. Asking prosecutor, do you want to do something? And then letting the prosecutor decide yes or no without any leaning one way or the other. Hey, prosecutor, you really need to call the deputy clerk closer to the line. Just, do you want to do this? Yes or no? Okay, well, then the objection is sustained. What do you want to do next? Right, there's no test. There's been no addition to what the prosecutor's done. There's been no distorting of what the prosecutor's done, which is what Quercia says is the line. That sort of what do you want to do is more the analytical, the dissecting of what the prosecutor's already put in front of the judge that has been permissible for 100 years. And that's the line that we're walking here with regard to 605, at least as interpreted in this broader fashion. Certainly, if this court wanted to interpret Rule 605 as being narrow and just being the judge formally on the witness stand, we would still have a fundamental error problem. And this kind of relates back, I think, to Justice Mueller's question earlier about, well, what if, you know, we just did less? We'd still have a biased judge involved here. If we took this out of the presence of the jury, we'd still have the judge involved in correcting the exhibit, which...
But the objection or the appeal then wouldn't be on vouching, would it? What would it be on?
It would be on appearance of, per se, appearance of judicial bias, and which is its own separate violation of constitutional rights. And that's where we get into the fundamental error, because that argument, admittedly, was not made. I suppose the district court and defense counsel kind of thought it was made in that post-trial motion, which was aimed at disqualifying
the judge. The judge recused himself.
The judge recused himself, and he said that the issue with 7C is, I made a mistake, it's a great issue for appeal, it probably will be appealed, which suggests that he thought it was ready to go. But I know this court's been fairly specific about preservation over the last couple of years, so I didn't want to make any sort of assumptions and risk Mr. Hopkins' rights in that regard. So, fundamental error. The First Circuit in Raimundi Hernandez actually just in 2020 found that a similar sort of intervention by the judge arose to the level of plain error, the federal court's equivalent to fundamental error, because it did undermine this constitutional right to an impartial judge. It had this impression, it gives this impression to the jury, especially here where it does happen in front of the jury, that the judge favors the government's version of events and that the jury should consider the government's evidence as being accurate. This per se appearance of bias is particularly evident when it appears the judge is stepping into the role of the prosecutor and helping the prosecutor make its case. That was the whole point of the First Circuit's decision in Rivera-Rodriguez in 2014, where the judge just gets so fed up with the awkward way that the prosecutor is questioning, the judge just steps in and takes over the question. And the First Circuit points out, that gives the jury the appearance that the judge is just, he's going to make sure the prosecutor's job gets done and gets done right. And that gives the appearance of bias, and we lose that constitutional protection.
It changes it from an adversarial proceeding to an inquisitorial proceeding.
Exactly, Your Honor. And so that's where those cases go. And the First Circuit, all their cases in this regard, look at plain error, due process sorts of claims. And they've consistently found it over the last 10, 15 years.
But does the fact that this is a court record matter at all in this analysis? I mean, doesn't the court itself have an interest in this because it is a court record?
Have an interest in making sure the jury sees it because it's a court record?
Or making sure that it's, I mean, if there's an authentication issue and the person who authenticated the document is there in the courthouse, that it be correct.
So if it were solely a matter of whether the document is correct, maybe. Where it's an exhibit proffered by the state to prove a point at trial, it's the state's job. It's the state's document, right? And it's the state's obligation to marshal its evidence to make sure it's properly certified and ready to go as an exhibit at trial. It's not for the judge to come in and do what the prosecutor should have done in the first place. What Judge Mitchell should have done here is simply said, objection sustained, or if we enter the realm of talking objections, that certification isn't sufficient. Objection sustained. What do you want to do next, prosecutor? And the evidence is he'd go to 7D. So it's not that the court record isn't incorrect, and the court's interest in making sure its own documents are correct isn't at issue here. What's at issue here is whether the state's copy that they're trying to present as evidence is correct. And it's the state's obligation to do that. It's not the district court's obligation to intervene and fix that for the state. I would point out just briefly on the fundamental error stuff that the error is clear from the record because everything happens on the record or a record is made later. And then the state has not challenged our argument that there is sufficient evidence to show that this objection was not strategic in the same way that this court found in Building Block and Easily. And then they effectively concede that a biased judge would be structural error, but here we can also prove, you know, prejudice actually occurred because, as I said earlier, without Exhibit 7C, the jury specifically found insufficient evidence on 7D, which means they left evidence of one conviction. They could not have found him guilty on the enhancement if 7C doesn't come in. So this is a critical, critical error.
And so in that regard, when the district judge says, we'll see if the clerk's here, and if the clerk isn't here, you'll have to get a corrected copy, how does that factor in? Because I'm struggling to go with, there wouldn't have been time for the prosecutor to get a corrected copy in light of that comment.
So the district court judge's comment in that regard does not contemplate the effects of Rule 16B, because we never got to that point, so it was never right to come up. Rule 16B requires the disclosure of evidence to be used at trial ahead of the trial. This court in Harris, Inc. in 2011 approved of it, affirmed the decision from the district court that said an amended version of an exhibit that's generated in the middle of trial is just too late to be admissible under the scheduling order. And
is that an abuse of discretion standard in review?
It would be an abuse of discretion review if ever we got there. We didn't get there. But the whole point is that the prosecutor couldn't have legitimately done that past the rule. You'd have to get excused by the judge.
Isn't the point it would have come up to the judge and the judge would have exercised his discretion to decide whether to let it in or not?
We would have a very different argument. I'd still be here complaining about it.
Right. And my point is, it seems like when we talk about some of these things in the fundamental error analysis on either side, we're necessarily getting into layers of hypotheticals upon hypotheticals.
Certainly, and that's part of it. But here, you know, where the end result is, you know, what actually happened here, if the judge got involved in changing the state's exhibit to correct what the judge perceived to be a bar to admissibility, that shows the appearance of bias, and that creates the violation of the constitutional right. And we have to remedy that, even if we also conclude that, yeah, the judge probably could have let it in as initially proper, because what the judge proceeded to actually do was error. So when we talk about these layers of hypotheticals, I'm reminded of this court's decisions in Maxim and Downing, to borrow from Fourth Amendment context and attenuation. We don't evaluate, in terms of whether the Fourth Amendment is violated, what the officers might have done had they not committed the error. We evaluate the impact of what they actually did. The same is true here. What this court actually did gave the appearance of impropriety in the presence of the jury.
Right, but in the context of a fundamental error analysis, you have to establish the prejudice, and you have to establish the outcome of the trial would have been different. And I'm struggling to see how we don't analyze those without hypothetical upon hypothetical. Maybe this would have happened, maybe that would happen.
We don't have to get there because the right of issue is biased judge, which is structural. The entire process is flawed from at that moment and cannot result in a just outcome. That was Vasquez in 2018, that if you show structural error, you don't have to prove the third prong to the same extent that you would with, say, a constitutional evidentiary type issue. So because we're showing biased judge, that we don't have to get to those layers of hypotheticals. To that same point, because it's this type of error, that's my rebuttal time. I'm fine using that now. because I do want to talk about the proper remedy just briefly. Here, where we're not talking about the ordinary trial error, we're not talking about the judge, as this court dealt with in Ingram just last week, with the judge making a decision about whether or not a felony reduced to a misdemeanor is viable evidence for enhancement. Just, it's a judgment call as to what the law requires. That's an ordinary trial error. It goes back for a new trial. This type of error is anything but ordinary. It falls under the guise of feign, where under due process, going back for a retrial is just inherently insufficient, and given the outrageous government conduct that occurred here, and the judge is an agent of the government for this purpose, and the prejudicial nature that it has as it played out in this case. We get back to some of your hypothetical questions there, Justice Sung, but again, what actually happened here is the jury had four exhibits. They found one of them insufficient. They convicted on three. One of them is the one that was erroneously admitted. That's the type of error that Fain's talking about when it says retrial just isn't good enough in this case. And if we were to weigh out any sort of benefit there, Mr. Auger-Lavoie is the only party here who didn't do anything wrong in the trial prep too. Why should he be the one that faces consequence and the state receiving none for this error, when it was the state's fault for not even marshaling his evidence ahead of time? With that, I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Initially, State's Exhibit 7C was self-authenticating and admissible as it was presented to the District Court. And I understand the District Court did ultimately may not have felt that way. They directed the Court to make this adjustment. But I think the admissibility is still relevant. It goes through the other issues, so I wanted to address that first. It complied with the requirements of Rule 902, which does not specifically require a date, let alone a month, to be included on the certification seal of a copy of a court record. Now, Auger-Lavoie contends that certification seals are additionally governed by Idaho Code 91406, but that statute does nothing of the sort. That statute simply provides an optional alternative means by which to provide a statement that's equivalent to a sworn statement. And it's a statute we became familiar with during COVID times when we were at home and didn't have access to notaries in the same way we had before. Basically, all the statute says is that if something requires a sworn statement, You may optionally, in the alternative, choose to submit a declaration that will have that same force. And that gives us the language that's typically used in those that we see about the statement being made under the penalty of perjury. I think this court described the statute as a kind of a lenient a means by which inmates can get the equivalent of sworn statements before this court.
Right, but if an attempt is made to do it the other way, can that be used to basically disregard any insufficiencies? Let's say there's something that does require a notarization, and the notarization was done improperly. Can you just say, oh, well, I affirm that then, and do it on the record, and then say it's fixed?
No, Your Honor, I think for an affidavit, something that needs to be sworn, it would have to satisfy the requirements of one or the other. If there's something wrong with the notary stamp, but it also fits the requirements of the declaration, which, again, are very, very lenient, basically just a statement that this is true to the best of my knowledge under the penalty of perjury, it's very difficult to not submit something that counts as a sworn affidavit based on the lenient nature of that statute. So one or the other, but if one fails at one, you know, the statute lets us know that this alternative means, if that information is there, works just as well. What the statute does not do in any way is provide any requirements or add any requirements to Rule 902 and the self-authentication requirement, which, once again, does not require a month, does not require a date specifically. And I suppose if we really want to get technical, the date was correct here, and that it was a certain date in January. I don't want to be that cute with it, but it is the 23rd day of 2021 or whatever it was. But no date was required, so I think the fact that this was admissible as presented to it really brings this in line to more of a clerical correction that the court was making than anything substantive with an evidence admission. It's closer to correcting a number on an exhibit or something like that, where it doesn't have any impact on the admissibility, the weight, really, even the substance of anything, and especially practically in this case, as I think the state pointed out, there were two otherwise identical seals on the Idaho judgments that were submitted here. Same clerk, same year, same date. So it would have been pretty apparent from the jury that these were two identical seals submitted by the clerk, and the moment is omitted on one.
So do you think what happened here can be properly characterized as vouching?
No, Your Honor, and that leads me directly into the Rule 605. I think this is really the opposite of vouching, in a sense, because rather than add information to a record, the court identified perhaps the only person in the courthouse or one of the few people in the courthouse who had the authority to do this. So rather than add anything, rather than comment on the evidence, rather than modify an exhibit to make it admissible or to have it have more weight, the court identified, again, this one individual or in a small group of individuals who statutorily and within the rule, I should say, have the power to authenticate a document in this way, and didn't tell the clerk what to put on there. It was up to the clerk. And this would have been very evident to the jury as well, since they had this seal on this exhibit. They had this seal on the other exhibit. They see the clerk's name. They see that the clerk certifies that this is correct. They see that the clerk has put in the year and the date. They see that the clerk has signed this. The fact that now we know the clerk additionally added the month a little bit later on one of these exhibits than the other, I fail to see how that is testimony or vouching in any sense of that word.
It may not be vouching. In the way you describe it, it may not sound so bad. But I guess my concern is about all of this was happening on the record in front of the jury. Let me paint you a slightly different scenario, and I will take the fifth whether I've actually seen this happen or not. But let's just say during a trial there's an affidavit referred to, and the witness is on the stand talking about their own affidavit, and it gets noticed that the affidavit was actually never notarized. And the deputy court clerk sitting next to the judge says, oh, I'm a notary. So she reaches over, grabs the exhibit, and notarizes it, and hands it back to the witness, all in front of the jury. There's something about that that fundamentally strikes me as wrong.
There's something, I think that, you know, this is the kind of case, Your Honor, when you describe what happens, for anyone who's done a trial or presided over a trial, it feels procedurally improper.
It feels like you're making the record you're going to present to the jury in front of the jury.
It's certainly at the very least not the best practice. It's something that
I'm glad you can see that.
But where it's ultimately not objected to, and you know, where opposing counsel having not had this objection, they're kind of stuck with Rule 605, this unusual rule that says you don't have to object, and fundamental error. Does it go into one of these buckets? And you know, even the way that you describe it, procedurally improper, I think this could have been done differently as well, Your Honor. But ultimately, I don't think that is testimony from any party there, and I don't think there's any bias on the part of any party there, any fundamental constitutional error that is structural error that requires a vacating of a conviction with no trial.
But what about in front of the jury, the appearance of the presiding judge helping the prosecutor admit an exhibit?
Your Honor, I think from the jury's perspective, this is going to look like a formality that there is nothing. What the jury learned from this is that a clerk who has already added the month on one exhibit is now adding it on another exhibit. I can't think of another scenario that is less material, less substantive, less important to whether these are valid judgments or not. This, I would say, much closer, like I said, along the lines of, well, that exhibit, we accidentally called that State's Exhibit C. Oh, that's supposed to be Defendant's Exhibit B. Let's just cross that out. It's much more in the realm of kind of a clerical correction. And I think that, you know, the judge recognized something that it did that perhaps favored the defense in its order, kind of recusing itself from the case. I would suspect if we're just concerned not so much about the materials here, whether they matter, but the court helping somebody, I think the court's example of how they helped the defense in this case was probably a lot more substantive than adding a button.
I don't know that I agree with that.
Well, we certainly don't need to compare them. We just need to prevail here, Your Honor.
I think we have an obligation to properly instruct the jury, and so that's where... But, you know, what I'm wondering about is if I'm understanding you correctly, it's that the jury didn't appreciate, from a legal perspective, the significance of whether an objection is sustained or overruled, and to them, it's just this lady who signed these other documents is coming in to add something to this document. And they may not appreciate in that or see bias, because in their mind, it's just she left something off and now she's going to write it in.
And you mentioned bias, and I think these issues overlap a bit, but I think it's a little bit more than that, Your Honor, where I would say that the jury correctly recognized that this was not assisting the state in any material way. I think the jury recognized, especially I think the context of this and why the judge perhaps made this lack of best practice error, is that there was kind of a hurry at this point. The jury had already been almost excused prior to the first trial. They're called back. You can kind of see a little bit of tension in the transcript about moving this along. So the idea that we can just add this month, I think that the jury would see that for exactly what it was. This thing that we know is on this other judgment. It's clearly something the clerk does. It's clearly something the clerk fills in. It's clearly something the clerk has authority and power on. Let's find that person so they can do that. That's why I think this is perhaps the opposite of vouching, in that it's deferential to the clerk's authority to do that, and that's what the court's saying. Can we get the clerk to get involved here? The clerk was the same person that was involved before. So I think the jury would have correctly seen this as not substantive or really any type of assistance given to the state.
Well, was there a witness on the stand when this happened?
Oh, that I don't recall. It certainly happened in front of the jury. I don't believe there was a witness. Yes.
I mean, if the state and the defense were making arguments to the judge and the state proffers these records without a witness on the stand, is that different than if there had been a police officer on the stand trying to admit the exhibit and then the judge assisted the police officer in admitting an exhibit he wanted to admit?
I think, Your Honor, yes. And what happened here, the former example, without a police officer in particular on the stand, I think that does make the whole situation seem more of a formality, more of a clerical correction or addition to something, where we're trying to straighten out these documents. All right, we're getting through this jury. We know that we're making you stay a little longer, but we just got to get everything in order here. Let's get the clerk, the one who has the power to do that, to participate here.
And to be honest with you, I'm struggling with the idea that these could be admitted without a police officer on the stand. I'm wondering how they did that, but I guess we need to read the transcript more closely.
I think sometimes when these second, I think this court has seen, and I have seen in these secondary trials, just like kind of restitution hearings. Sometimes there's kind of a casual. I mean, everybody's just completed this stressful trial. We have this verdict, and now there's this part that seems simpler. And I think this court.
What is worse, I could not agree with you more. The secondary phase takes on far less formality, and it has a very ad hoc feel to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a dangerous trend that I see.
Yes, Your Honor, it can be, and this court has vacated persistent violator enhancements kind of based on those types of errors being made. And I don't think this falls into that bucket where, once again, the clerk is the one that has the power to do that. The clerk, I mean, it's if the clerk did this yesterday and put this stamp here, and then added this month, the exact same person the day after, I don't think this signals anything substantive to the jury about this being vouching, this being testimony, let alone the judge being biased against the defendant entirely, requiring a vacated conviction on those enhancements. So generally, Your Honor, this is just simply far afield from the type of scenarios, going back to just 605, wrapping up that. And this court hasn't adopted a broader view of 605. It hasn't come up very often. I think one of the cases that was cited was an unpublished opinion that I remember because I had written a brief in, where I actually acknowledged that 605 might have been an issue in a particular case. And I think you can't have a more distinguishing situation than what happened there, which was also a persistent violator trial where the judge was the fact finder. And I don't think this is what happened, but I acknowledge that if the judge, as the fact finder, found a felony conviction based upon the judge's own knowledge that the defendant had been convicted of a felony, that takes us into the realm of 605. And I think that's the type of situation that 605, and this court hasn't even gone that far. I think I made a concession in this case that the Supreme Court had not itself recognized yet as far as the broadness of 605. But I think that's a great example, that case, of the type of scenario that 605, this extraordinary rule where no objection is necessary, and as far as we know, hasn't really been before this court, I think in a criminal context, perhaps at all. But this situation with a missing month and directing the very person who has the authority to do it and put the rest of the information on that seal doesn't rise to that type of level. And this was not testimony, and it did not constitute a violation of Rule 605. And I think opposing counsel mentioned the other one. This is the type of case where you really have to go back to the 1930s to find examples. I think when maybe trials were done as casually as some restitution hearings might be sometimes. But I think opposing counsel mentioned a case where the judge noticed that a witness was rubbing his hands together, and that indicated to him that this witness was not credible, and told the jury, "I don't believe a word this witness said, except for the parts where he agreed with the government. Everything else he said is a lie." Now you can go deliberate on the case. I think that's a segue into the and these are kind of stunning examples that actually happen, and I think that's where a lot of this law is created, and it's a lot of the citations of Audre Lavoie's cases involve situations like that. And I think saying that gets into the fundamental error standard and judicial bias. And judicial bias, likewise, like Rule 605. We don't see a lot of judicial bias claims, and even less so made successfully, because typically when they are found, it's situations like that. And we know from the case law that a claimant has to make show much more than the judge made a trial court error, an evidentiary error, that the defendant was aggrieved by some ruling. That's typically the arguments you see. I do a lot of pro se habeas when people allege bias of judges. That's the type of arguments. They ruled against me, this and that. But it's very clear that those types of things do not show judicial bias. At worst here, and the judge did something procedurally improper or perhaps not the best practice, but even if it was error, there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest this was done based upon some bias or personal stake in the case, as opposed to what the judge, I think, candidly said. What happened here was that he acted in haste, again, seemingly to move this trial along when there had been some delays and the jury had thought they were going home, but they were not yet. And I think from the context of all of this, to the extent that it was something procedurally improper, that's what it was based on. And I do want to clarify, this does appear to be a judicial bias structural error claim. That is different than claims about a judge saying something improper or saying something that might prejudice the jury. In fact, in a structural error situation, it's a very high standard. This, you've been tried and convicted by a judge who's biased against you. That's the claim that Argo LaVoy is making here. And I'll note a number of the cases, especially the series of first circuit cases that are cited, Pava, Romero-Rodriguez, Raymond Hernandez, First Circuit cases, all of those involve prejudice analysis. The first one, the field test case, was actually found to be harmless. The judge's comments about, well, here's what a field test is, and here's what it involves. Those other cases also involved prejudice analyses. So here, we're outside of that box entirely, and this is a structural error case. And to show that, we need a lot more than a judge who perhaps improperly acted in haste and had a clerk fill in a month on a certification seal. I guess finally, Your Honor, if the court does find reversible error based on either the rule, the Constitution, or whatever grounds, the appropriate remedy certainly would be remand for a new trial on the persistent violator enhancement. There's no sufficiency problem. There was no double jeopardy. There's no outrageous government conduct. And most importantly, no practical reason this case could not be retried in the extraordinary situations that this court and other appellate courts have precluded the state from retrying a defendant upon some type of error like this. It's usually, if there's a practical reason for it, the state had destroyed evidence, so it wouldn't be fair to have a trial. Maybe egregious prosecutorial misconduct, and the court doesn't want to throw the case back to the same prosecutor, the second time as we've done that, doesn't want to throw the case back to the same prosecutor that committed this egregious misconduct. There's a practical reason there. Here, we don't have that type of practical reason. A Rule 605 or constitutional analysis, if there was an error made here, then there is a consequence to the state that there would have to be a new trial. And the final thing I wanted to note, and I'm not sure exactly where it fits in, something I noticed, the jury verdict form here was very unusual in that it asked the jury to find specifically whether Audrey LaVoy had committed individual convictions. So the way the verdict form was listed, that is true that there was only three, and they apparently did not find the California one, though that might also have been equal because they were told they only had to find two, so they might have found the first two. Regardless of that, even if 7C was thrown out, I think we talked about a little bit the consequences of that, even if 7C was out, 7A and B itself contained four felony convictions committed on different dates. So unless I'm missing something, I'm not sure why the state, and I could be missing something because I didn't notice that when I was briefing it, but I'm not sure why the prosecutor didn't proceed just on 7A and B since that contains four convictions within that judgment. But I think that might just fit in. I think Justice Zahn had a question about what might have happened and the layers of speculation if we get into harmless error on any of these things. And I think what would have happened is, A, the state would have been able to get another copy of 7C from the same court, the same clerk we know was in the building. So I think after a short recess, it seemed like the court was very willing to let the state do that, which would have just taken a few minutes longer, presumably. Also, if the verdict form was written in a different way, the state could have simply proceeded on 7A and B as well. Unless there's any additional questions, the state would respectfully request this court to affirm the persistent violator conviction sentencing enhancement.
Thank you, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
8 minutes.
Sir.
May it please the court. I think it's important to take a step back. The state did a lot of arguing about how this is a formality that the jury wouldn't perceive as being helpful to the state. Yet in their brief, page 7, right at the bottom, this is how the state describes what happened. The district court implicitly sustained the objection by refusing to admit the exhibit as is and instead directing court clerks to add the month of certificate to the seal. That's what the jury saw. That's exactly what the jury saw. They saw this judge, when the exhibit didn't satisfy the requirements in the judge's mind, take the exhibit from the prosecutor, make sure that it got the information that the judge felt it needed, and then said, now you want to present this exhibit that I fixed for you? And the prosecutor says yes. And as the affidavit from the post-trial motion notes, during the second one of these instances, defense counsel leaned over to the prosecutor, did you ask him to do that? No. The judge was doing that by himself. That's the appearance of bias. That's what the jury is seeing happen in this case.
Is that conversation between counsel and the record?
It was made in the record by affidavit of defense counsel after the fact. It's in, I think it's her second amended affidavit. I think the specific citation's in my brief. But that's what the jury is seeing happen. They're seeing the judge sustain an objection, take over the exhibit, make it right, and then giving it back to the prosecutor and saying, now, is this what you want to do? That's the appearance of bias. The judge is helping the prosecutor make his case. The judge is supervising the creation of the state's evidence on the bench. This is not an ordinary trial error. This is not a formality that the jury would not have understood what was going on. And as counsel noted, this trial was already fraught with animosity between the court and the prosecutor, because the prosecutor waited until the absolute last second to remind the judge that there was a part two that he hadn't even prepared jury instructions for. And the judge took him to task for that, both at the trial and after the trial. This was not a friendly exchange at the bench correcting a minor clerical error.
But if the judge had animosity for the prosecution, I'm wondering how that supports your bias claim from the defendant's perspective.
It's the appearance of bias. It's the per se appearance.
Sounds like
of bias.
He didn't like everybody.
He didn't like it because, remember, he'd also, in the trial part one, taken defense counsel to task for not submitting an instruction about the defendant's right to remain silent, having to draft one of those for her. That's why in his statement at the end, I shouldn't have helped either party. This judge was involved in the trial. He was not acting as a neutral magistrate. And that's where we've got the problem here when he then creates the exhibit under his supervision and direction, creates the exhibit that results in the second conviction as the state argued. This whole argument about 7A and B having four felonies, first off, new and new oral arguments are improperly considered. But also, there is case law in Idaho that talks about when there's a single judgment conviction on consolidated charges, it counts as one conviction for a prior, for an enhancement like this, because of the consideration of the opportunity to rehabilitate in between the convictions. You've got to have the convictions on different days. So the fact that 7A and B had different felonies committed on different days does not create a basis for conviction on its own. That's why the state had to resort to putting 7B in front of the jury, while when it appeared that 7C might actually be excluded. At the end of the day, this case represents an absolute breakdown in proper procedure. The judge is involved with an exhibit. The judge is an agent of the state when it comes to ensuring the defendant's constitutional rights are protected. That's this court's decision in full. Because he's an agent of the state, even if the state isn't fully responsible for the prosecutor isn't fully responsible for the judge's actions, the state as a governmental entity still bears responsibility for the judge's error in this case, the admitted error in this case. And so that should weigh against them when it comes to it. What remedy do we give Mr. Auger before? The only remedy that fixes this, that puts him back in the position he would have been but for the error, is to say the rest of your evidence wasn't good enough for the jury. We aren't going to give the state a second bite of the apple to actually properly marshal the exhibit, to actually present two properly certified judgments of conviction and prove your guilt. This one should weigh against the state, even just as a matter of lenity. Because as Justice Gorsuch pointed out in his Wooten concurrence, the whole point of the idea of lenity is to protect the very due process concerns that are at play in this case. That's why that's the proper remedy. To the extent that this is anything but ordinary, this court should send that message, that we need to stop treating these part twos as ad hoc, after-the-fact considerations, as Justice Mueller pointed out. It's a trial part two and should be treated as such. Evidence rules should apply, discovery rules should apply, and they should be followed because it's a formal proceeding that changes the range of sentencing from 5 years to life in this case. it should be treated with far more solemnity than it was in this case.
Thank you very much. With that, counsel, the matter is under advisement. We will render a decision. Appreciate the comments and argument today. We will be in recess until Monday at 8:50 back in place.
All rise, please.